Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we interview James Lapine about the release of the Into the Woods DVD. We review On the 20th Century, The Heidi Chronicles, Paint Your Wagon, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame at the Paper Mill Playhouse. Please stay tuned.
Never, never is much too quick. Never, he makes me much too sick. Let him save his own hateful hide. Let him know he's so hateful. I'd rather die.
Come back to him.
Failures have been fantastic.
Lily, come back to him. He might do something drastic. Lily, he hasn't a cufflink on which to borrow.
Lovely.
Then take his fear away tomorrow.
Never, that is the word I seek. Never, that is the word I
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 22nd, 2015. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia, Michael Fortantier, and Carrie Purcell. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade, to be released on April 7th. Peter, we're going to have to talk about that soon. I just got my preview copy in the mail.
Oh, good.
Very pretty cover.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Did you draw that yourself?
No.
Okay.
Hardly. The guy did a great job.
It's a beautiful cover. Mm-hmm. Peter's columns, they appear at MTI Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also joining us for the first time on Broadway Radio is Carrie Purcell. Carrie is a staff writer and features editor at Playbill.com. Her new column, A Woman's World, focuses on covering women's issues both on and off Broadway by highlighting successful women in the industry and challenges that they have faced. You can follow Carrie at Playbill Carrie on Twitter and her blog at CarriePurcell.com. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we have an embarrassment of the riches. last week, we spoke with Ted Chapin at Rodgers and Hammerstein. And this week, we spoke with James Lapine. Peter and I spoke with him early in the week. So let's play that recording for you now. With us today, we have a very special guest. James Lapine is with us. Broadway fans and Broadway Radio listeners will know Mr. Lapine from an astounding list of shows, but we want to focus on Into the Woods, which is coming out on Blu-ray and DVD on March 24th. And Mr. Lapine wrote the screenplay and the book for Into the Woods. So thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Fun to be here.
So tell us, what is significant about viewing the DVD of Into the Woods at home versus seeing it in the theaters? What's the differences in your opinion?
Well, you can watch it in your underpants, you can stop it and go to the bathroom and come back. It's always a great pleasure in life. You can rewind and revisit your favorite moments. I don't know. I think it is a different experience. I can't say that I can tell you exactly how, because it depends on who you are.
Well, on the other hand, what's really wonderful is you have the option of subtitles, and certainly with Stephen Sondheim lickety-split lyrics, it doesn't hurt to have them right there in front of us, does it?
Oh, can you also have a foreign language if you want to learn Sondheim?
Yes, you can. So really, who could...
Well, there's a tool I never thought to use. Great.
Funny. All right. Now, in terms of the movie, when you were putting it together, there must have been some moments that you felt very bad about losing from the original script and Broadway production. What did you reluctantly part company with?
Well, I think, first of all, I wanted to write the screenplay, but I also made the absolute proviso to Rob Marshall that I just wanted to not be precious about the show, and mostly what interested me about writing the screenplay was envisioning it as a film, and less so about being precious about the exactitude of the material itself. I mean, I would say, right off the bat, we decided to get rid of the narrator and Cinderella's father, and of course the one that was sort of a little heart-wrenching was losing the prominence of the baker's father, which of course ended up meaning the loss of the song No More. So, but, you know, for the most part, I didn't have a problem dumping anything.
All right, now, there's a scene where we see the castle where Cinderella is going to be going to the ball, and we hear music from A Little Night Music at that point. Was that something that you actually wrote into the script, or was that somebody else's
idea? No, not at all. It was something Rob came up with, and it was very amusing when it appeared. You know, when you're a writer on a movie, it's not like being a writer on stage, you know, where you have so much control and involvement in a production. Screenwriters generally turn their material over to the director. It's a director's medium, and you know, you can't be precious about it. You know, they do what they do to it, and that's kind of the pact you make when you enter writing a screenplay.
Of course, it was something that you really didn't think about when you were growing up, right? I mean, I know you were a graphic artist for a while.
Yes, it's true. No, I never thought about Cinderella's castle or Stephen Sondheim.
All right.
Anything, or musicals. Yes. Actually, it's not true about musicals because I grew up in a little town in Ohio called Mansfield, Ohio, and the most famous person in my town was Lee Adams, who was, you know, a great Broadway lyricist. So the first time I ever came to New York, we came to New York to see, you know, we didn't know this man, but the fact that he was from our hometown brought us to New York to see Bye Bye Birdie. So that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. All right. But going back, what suddenly is a third of a century, there you are, and you understand that Stephen Sondheim is going to meet with you and perhaps there'll be a collaboration. How nervous are you, or are you nervous at all?
You know what? I wasn't nervous at all because, as you mentioned, I was a graphic artist and a photographer, and my trajectory into the theater was so peculiar. And when I had met Steve, I had I'd written two plays and directed a musical. That was it. And I had only seen one Sondheim show, which was Sweeney Todd. Of course the name sort of had a resonance, but it just didn't strike me as being, you know, life-changing or anything. I just thought, oh, this will be interesting and see what this man is like. And in a way, I'm so glad, because I probably would have been really nervous had I really known, you know, his incredible body of work. But, and it was
so
funny because then, I was just going to say,
he
started giving me, you know, audio tapes of his shows and scripts, and I started reading these and listening to them. I thought, oh, yeah, this thing, A Little Night Music, is really good. You know,
so
my education went backwards. So
it's a good thing he didn't come from Mansfield, Ohio.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. I mean, but working with Stephen Sondheim had to be like 12 dreams come true. So as a result, there you are. When do you realize? Does it take a day? Does it take an hour? Does it take weeks before he says, yes, James, I'm going to work with you on a project?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I had met him about a project that I wanted to do that it's probably boring for your listeners. Just somebody that I had told about the project, producer knew him and called him up and suggested we meet. And Steve took time to read it and said, I don't want to do it. It reminds me too much of Candide, which I've already done. And, but you know, I'd be happy to talk to you about other things. And, so I think we just met a few times and, I had done Sunday in the Park as part of the very first thing I ever did in the theater, and I just sort of brought the image into the painting, and we just sort of looked at it, and you know, I said, "Gee, doesn't it look like a stage set?" And we talked, and you know, he seemed mildly interested, and then I said, "But there's somebody missing, missing," and he said, "Who?" And I said, "The artist," and he went, "Oh, you know." So I just started writing, And we started meeting, and I came in, and I'd show him 4 or 5 or 6 pages, and he'd read it, and we'd kind of talk about it, and then go off again. And essentially, he didn't write anything, and I had a commission at Playwrights Horizon, so I figured, well, I'm going to write this thing, and, you know, maybe it'll work out with Stephen Sondheim, but in any event, I'll have a show or a play if it's not a musical. So he didn't really jump in until, I would say, the first act was finished. And when I say jump in, I mean jump in writing. He was certainly intrigued by what I was doing and thinking a lot about how music might be involved in it, but he didn't really start writing it till it was, the first act was done, which I would imagine was probably 3-4 months. We wrote that show pretty quickly.
But this brings up an interesting point. He has always been notorious for being late in delivery, or at least right up to the wire in delivering material. And did you know this in advance? Did people say to him, James, don't expect him to give you material quickly. I mean, he takes a long time, and just when you think he's not going to give it to you, he's going to give it to you. Anything like that?
No, the funny thing is, I'm just the opposite kind of person. Like, I can't write anything unless I know somebody has to look at it, you know, in June 12th, and then I know, okay. And I sort of did that with him. I said, well, I'm going to do a reading of this and playwrights. And so he wrote the first 5 chords of the show, and we showed up for a reading. It was very funny at Playwrights, and they drag a piano on the stage, and Steve got up. You know, everybody's, at least the playwrights, is coming and thinking, oh, Stephen Sondheim's kind of musical, you know. And he plays the first 5 chords, and then he sits down, and that was it. And we just read the book. So, but then we scheduled the workshop, and then I didn't know whether he was a prompt writer or not. And in fact, I did learn by the time we got to Broadway and we were putting on a second act that was half written. But, you know, again, I think ignorance is bliss. And as I said, I didn't come from the business. If it all ended with Sunday in the Park with George, I might just as easily gone back and opened up a graphic design office. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. I was a little stressed out by the time we got to Broadway, just because I knew the show cost a lot of money and I had producers who were wringing their hands. But the point is, he never wants to write the wrong song. And every song that came in that second act made it more and more complete until the final one came in a couple days before critics came. And you know, it's why he is who he is. He knows exactly what he's doing, and it takes him a while to do it, but it's never the wrong song. It's the right song. And I think that's what you want. I'd rather, he used to say to me, do you want it Tuesday or do you want it good? You know, and of course, the answer is, I want it good. So there it is. You know, if you can't get it there by Tuesday, then it'll be the following Tuesday. And when it's done, it'll be done.
All right. So you were interested in doing another show with him right away. Some people, of course, work with people and then never work with them again. Did you suggest Into the Woods? Did he? How did that happen?
No, we just got together and just started talking about what another show might be. And it was funny because we had an offer to do Sunday in the Park as a movie. And I was so excited about the possibility of doing that. And I was going to get to write it and direct it. And Steve sort of said, you know, I really don't want to do that. Let PBS film it or something. I want to write a new show. And, you know, part of me was like, wah, and the other part was like, well, golly, you know, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you, so of course, let's do a new show. And I have to tell you, working with this man is a dream. I mean, it's just really a dream. There's just nobody better to be in a room with and talking to and working with and having fun with. And so, you know, working on another show was not something I didn't mind jumping into that because we had so much fun on the first one. So we just got together and started talking, and I think he said he was interested in doing something like a Quest musical or he doesn't remember this, but I know, you know, I think he played Dungeons and Dragons or just something that was about people going after something or trying to find something or solve something. And I suggested a fairy tale, doing a fairy tale, because I was very interested in Jungian you know, thinking at the time. And so I went off and wrote, began to write a fairy tale, and I found it super difficult to do, simply because fairy tales by their nature are very short, and the minute you try to really expand one, I just found it was dissipating it. And then I had this idea of taking this original one that I started to write and weaving it with existing ones and making a whole new one. And then we went into the idea, which was also an idea with Sunday, of having a second act that goes beyond the finished product, as it were. So that's kind of how it rolled out. And on that show, I wrote the opening for Into the Woods, and I said to Steve, you know what, I don't think this is a musical. There's no way you're going to be able to musicalize this. You know, it's so many stories and it's so much exposition. And I was like, this is never going to happen. Little did I know it was probably the exact right thing to say, because you tell Stephen Sondheim you can't do something, he's going to show you you can. And he did, you know, and he wrote that really fast, and it came back really fast, and it was like fantastic, you know. I thought, my God, you know. Of course, that's his genius, to be able to take all that information and weave it together like that coherently with the dialogue. It was pretty exciting. So that show began to write itself much more quickly.
It's very interesting to me, because having seen Follies in Boston, when he had a song in called Can That Boy Foxtrot, I remember somebody calling me and saying, he's dropping that song, he's putting in a new one. And I thought, what can he write that's better than that one? That one's so wonderful. And he showed me with I'm Still Here, I'll tell you. He certainly did. One of my great thrills early on was seeing William Finn's In Trousers, and I thought he was going to be a tremendous voice in the American theater. I called up everybody I knew that night after seeing it, and when I finished calling everybody, I then called everybody on the West Coast, because it was 3 hours earlier, to say, this guy is really going to be something. How did you get into falsettos? Did you see In Trousers by any chance, or how did
you know what? I never did see In Trousers. I saw it later when it was revived, but I didn't see it. But we were working together at Playwrights Horizons. I was doing a play called Table Settings, and he was doing In Trousers. I was upstairs in the little theater. He was down in the big one. And I didn't get a chance to see it, but he saw my show, Table Settings, and he just thought that I would be somebody he wanted to work with. So he came after me, you know, and I said, well, I've never directed a musical. I've barely directed a play. But we jumped in together. I mean, it was a whole different kind of era and time, you know. I think we did 14 shows at Playwrights then, and, you know, upstairs was like putting a show on in your attic. It wasn't precious or anything, and Andre just said, here, you've got, you know, a month to rehearse it and a month to run it and do it. And there was no oversight or anything. And Bill had written about, I wouldn't say even half the score. And it was, to some degree, an extension of In Trousers. So that's how we were sort of thrown together. And that was a magical, really magical time and collaboration.
Well, also, it was one of the most significant musicals for so many people who saw their lives or what their lives should have been unfold before them. What did you realize early on that this was going to be a groundbreaking show, or did it only come afterwards when you saw people's reactions to it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, groundbreaking? No. It's like the furthest thing from my mind. I got news for you. I was just sort of more, just to speak a little bit about the times, you know, I wouldn't say uncomfortable or nervous, but what was the unknown of it was the gayness of it. And, you know, when I look back, I don't know, because I hadn't gone to that much theater, but I'd certainly never seen material like that in the theater. You know, I mean, there was like The Boys in the Band or something, but a musical about, you know, a guy who leaves his wife and hooks up with another guy, and they're Jews, and it was just like, how many people can we offend in one show? And we did. I mean, with beginning a show with four Jews in a room bitching, there were people who didn't make it past that number. But no, groundbreaking was, I don't think anybody who writes anything that's you know, that has a kind of success thinks they're writing something that's maybe some people do. I don't know. Maybe Lin-Manuel knew Hamilton was going to be groundbreaking. I don't know. But, you know, the same with Sunday. I didn't know. First of all, when I did Sunday, you know, the audience was walking out in droves, and they were having none of it when we were in previews. And, you know, I was just shocked. I just thought, well, what's wrong with this? But I had never done a Broadway show. I didn't know that this was a different kind of show than people were used to seeing, you know. And that was a show that really needed criticism and critics to tell them. And not, believe me, a lot of critics felt the same way of not liking it. But once it found its audience and people had a sort of sense of expectation about it, it worked fine. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that way. And Falsettos was, I think it was just great. I mean, it was partially because it was in like an 80-seat theater and it was so in your face. And those performers were so great. And Bill's voice was unique. There's no question about it.
All right, there's that famous moment in Falsettos when Michael Rupert is in bed with his boyfriend and he picks up the sheet and takes a good long look at what's under that sheet. Was that your idea?
I think it was, yes.
Okay. Another.
I'm glad you reminded me of it because I don't even remember it, but that sounds like something I would do.
One of my favorite moments in your production of Annie was having Grace Farrell see Sandy during the first act and alerting the policeman about that. I thought that was terrific because, really, at the end of Annie, every other Annie we've seen, suddenly there's that dog there, and how did it happen? How did that
dog happen? I know. I'm a bit of a logic Nazi, and I just say I have to make sense. I can't direct something I can't make sense of, so thank you for noticing that.
Yeah, I thought that was terrific. When I was talking to Sondheim during Passion, I had to put my questions to him in advance, send them to him in advance. And I said, Passion is derived from an obscure Italian film, and he crossed out the word obscure. He didn't want that said for whatever reason. My question to you, was it an obscure movie to you? Did you know it? Did you bring it up to him, or did he bring it up to you?
He brought it up to me, and he knew the movie very well. But what I would have done is scratched out your question and said, it's not derived from the movie, it's derived from the book.
Uh-huh.
Because I thought the movie was interesting. I didn't adore it. And then I went we were able to get a hold of the Italian novel that it's based on, and we had it translated. And once I read the novel, Passione d'Amore, I fell in love with it, and the book of that is really, I mean, the book of the musical is really more inspired by the book than the movie. So, but Steve, you know, a connection to the movie. He had seen it in film festivals, and I guess it wasn't obscure in the world at large. It was just obscure. I'm sorry, I forgot to turn off the phone, so there's a phone call coming in. It was not obscure in the world at large. I guess it was Ettore Scola, a pretty well-known filmmaker.
All right, here's my last question. Given the fact that you didn't grow up in the theater per se, here you are adapting Act One, a book that many of us read when we were children, or at least teenagers. The question becomes, did you read it only recently, or had you read it a long time ago?
Somewhere in between. I would say I probably read it in my 40s, when I had heard people mention it hither and yon, and it is a reference point for so many people. So I read it, I would say probably when I was 40 or 50, you know, maybe 20 years ago, something like that.
All right. And did the idea hit you right then to adapt it, and you got around to it later, or was it only
later? You know, I see everything, so I saw it as a movie, but I knew there had been a movie made, and at the time we couldn't find the movie.
Yeah,
but, you know, what struck me so much about that was we all relate to it, but I particularly related to it because of you know, the age difference between Moss Hart and George Kaufman, and my age difference between Sondheim and myself. The fact that, you know, I was living in a hovel in the Lower East, you know, not even the East Side, down in the financial district, and I would go up to Sondheim's house, which was, you know, just elegant townhouse. So I hadn't even ever been in a townhouse like that, you know. So when I read the book, it so touched me to see his story and relate it to myself. And Moss Hart became a writer and director. Anyway, it just touched me probably in ways that other people didn't relate to it, just by virtue of my own experience.
So let me bring it quickly back to the release of the DVD of Into the Woods. On the large screen, one of the songs that was written for the movie was cut, She'll Be Back, and we see this on the DVD. How happy were you with the final decisions that the studio gets to make on these things? As you know, that the Hollywood versus Broadway is such a different medium where the decision-making lies. Were you able to get out, and are you happy with the DVD, including the She'll Be Back?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I've done work with studios before, including Disney, and it didn't feel like that on this. Rob Marshall had Final Cut, and, he was the driving force behind the movie, and I would say the relationship with the studio and us was generally pretty good. There were certainly points of difference of opinion along the way. When it came to this, however, it really came as a result of having tested the movie, and Steve and I had not we had seen a rough cut of the movie, but we hadn't seen it with an audience or anything. And it just became obvious, and not surprisingly, that it held up the action of the movie and the audiences. I think what it really did was diminish The Last Midnight, because the two came into fairly close proximity to one another in film time. And there was just, it didn't really forward the action. It was really a song that's sort of more reactive than active. So, I mean, all those things contributed to Rob feeling it should be taken out. And Steve and I both said, it's your movie. Yeah. And Steve just said, if you take it out, can you put it on the CD or, mm-hmm. Or the DVD? And of course, Disney and Rob said, absolutely. So, it wasn't that big, it was an unfortunate thing that happened, just because Meryl's so good and it's so exciting to have Steve do a new song. But at the end of the day, I think it was the right choice, the right call.
Well, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time and visiting with us on Broadway Radio. And anything coming up that you want us to know about? If you had a chance to go back and do one show that you've done in the past, what would it be?
Wow. I just don't like going, I don't want to go back.
Okay. That's fair. Go going forward.
Which doesn't mean I'm not going back to doing falsettos, but I'm at a point where I want to write new things and do new things. And going back is hard and fascinating and interesting. And by the way, I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to do that. But I don't have any, I've been asked to do things of mine in the past, and I might have done them, but I don't have a desire to do them now. I really want have a desire to make new things. So,
and we'll look forward to them.
Okay, thank you so much. Nice talking to you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
She don't say yes, don't lift her dress. She's safe and down, she don't lie down. She turn the tide with fiery
into the last home stretch of the Broadway season where everything is going to open up between now and May something or end of April. And four of us got a chance to see On the 20th Century. So this roundabout production revival is playing down at the American Airlines Theater. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Yeah, this is a wonderful musical that did really get its due back in 1978 because Ain't Misbehavin' opened just around the same time it did. Off-Broadway, I'll grant you. But suddenly this five-person, one-set review with nobody terribly famous in it was the toast of the town because nobody expected anything from it. But on the other hand, when a musical is being written by Betty Comden, Adolph Green, Cy Coleman, and being directed by Hal Prince, well, these are champions, and as a result, a lot was expected from it. So it became the thing to do to praise Ain't Misbehavin' to the skies and look down a little on 20th Century. Had a respectable run, absolutely, ran a year, a little more, and pleased a lot of people, but it didn't win the Best Musical Award. Ain't Misbehavin' did, and as a result, it suffered. Even though Betty and Adolph won for Best Book and Cy Coleman won for Best Score, the fact remained that unfortunately, Ain't Misbehavin' won, and it really hurt the show. So it's taken a long time for this to come back. I mean, when you think of it, because this is also a show, one of the rare long runners, so to speak, and a year is still then considered a long run, that only has had one cast album. There were no productions that yielded another one. When it was in London, it didn't run a long time either. So welcome back, 20th Century. Yeah, all right, for those of us who start in 1978, this isn't nearly as opulent. But by roundabout standards, and I don't mean that as a criticism, by contemporary standards, by 2015 standards, it's a very opulent show. I went last Tuesday, and of course we've heard a lot about Peter Gallagher's vocal problems because he's missed a lot of performances. Well, you could have fooled me. I think he sounds fine. No problem whatsoever. I also enjoyed Mary Louise Wilson's take on the character of Mrs. Primrose, the crazy lady who claims she's got a lot of money and are going to finance Oscar Jaffe, that's Peter Gallagher, his new show about Mary Magdalene because she's really into religion and she doesn't have a dime, and we find out later that literally, she's a nut. And I thought her take on the character was better than Imogene Coca's because it was more grounded in reality. And the thing is, the way Imogene Coca played, everybody would have seen through immediately that she was a person who was crazy and would not be able to put up the money. Mary Louise Wilson made a convincing case for the fact that she had money in the bank. So that was pretty good. What surprised me, however, is that at the bows, at the curtain call, the last one, of course, by Christian Chenoweth, who I'll get to. Second was Peter Gallagher. And the next curtain calls taken together were by Michael McGraw and Mark Lynn Baker, who played the henchmen that help Oscar Jaffe anytime he's really in trouble. And I was a little surprised Mary Louise Wilson didn't get that bow. However, maybe they feel that Mark Lynn Baker and Michael McGraw earned it because they really were superb in the not big roles. They're not big roles, you know, just helping out Oscar Jaffe to make things happen. Kristen Chenoweth plays Lily Garland, this movie star who was Mildred Plotka until Oscar Jaffe discovered her. And unfortunately, as always happens in these cases, he wants to hold the upper hand at all times. So she broke away from him. She went to Hollywood. She won an Oscar. Very funny bit involving an Oscar, by the way. And now she has a new boy toy in Andy Carl, whom we remember fondly from Rocky. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here. And that is the fact that Andy Carl is a muscular guy. And at one point, director Scott Ellis even has him flex his muscles to show how strong he is. Fine. Okay. However, there's a lot of physical comedy in this show where the two henchmen try to prevent him from entering a room or leaving a room and that type of thing. And really, he could beat them up with eight fingers tied behind his back. I mean, you know, so that's a real problem. You know, I mean, they paint themselves into a corner because of that. All right, Kristen Chenoweth, yeah, terrific as you'd expect. I have to admit, I thought she might have been a little too small for the part because it's a grand lady. I mean, she is only 4'11", but maybe they just cast people who are around her height. But it didn't seem to me that she seemed small up there at all, and she certainly doesn't seem small when she sings because she has a marvelous voice, and you need a marvelous voice for this part. part. It's one of the reasons that Madeline Kahn back in 1978 wasn't happy with the show, because indeed there she was struggling with this music, and Judy Kaye had to come in and rescue the show, and she really did. She did something at the end of a song called Babette, a big production number, 11 o'clock number, that was sensational. Whenever I listen to the cast album, I really miss what Judy Kaye did with Babette at the end. Though I also have to say that one night I went and Judy Kaye was out, and I saw this unknown Christine Ebersole, and she was the best of the three, but that's another story. Anyway, so I think it's a solid revival. I think it's going to bring a lot of people a lot of pleasure. I think it's going to redeem the show tremendously. And for those of us who have memories from 78, we have to put them aside and just say, well, nothing's the way that it was. And it's not, we can't expect the opulence that we had back then. And let's just accept and be very grateful and lucky that we have it back on Broadway.
Michael, what did you think about it?
Well, Peter, I'm glad you mentioned Babette, because I thought exactly the same thing. And frankly, I was surprised that Kristen didn't do that little obligato or whatever you want to call it. Maybe she's completely unaware of it, because
that's probably true. Yeah.
Yeah. But other than that, she was really great. I expected her to be fantastic in this role. I guess maybe she wears really high heels. I didn't specifically focus on that, but I think she must, because you're right. She's a tiny little woman. But so wonderful. Just her kind of comedy, I think, and so beautiful. And the voice sounds better than ever. Peter Gallagher was in the performance I went, which was in the middle of him missing a tremendous amount of them. I thought, for the most part, he was much better than I ever thought he would be. He initially sounded somewhat miscast to me in terms of type. I think he pulled it off very well. He was, to me, extremely British. I mean, like, to the point of trying to be actually British rather than just affected American. And he's not supposed to be, so I don't know if that's an issue, but it did help the character, him play that type of character, I think. For the most part, he sounded fine when I went. I did notice him kind of skirting the high notes, trying to sort of like not sustain them maybe as long as they're supposed to be. And there was one unfortunate moment. The first notes of Our Private World were terribly flat, really, to the point where I gasped, and I think the person I was with did also. So I don't know if that was part of the lingering illness or just that's really not his kind of singing. I'm sorry to hear that. Did you guys hear that they've announced he's going to be out again? Well, as we're recording today, Sunday the 22nd, and I don't believe a reason was given, but people are saying it's for previous commitments rather than illness. And if that is true, I just, you know, that's a new trend that
I'll tell you what I've heard. It doesn't make it true, but what I've heard is he's purposely taking the day off because they're recording tomorrow and he wants to sound good tomorrow.
Oh,
well. If you find out that's not true, don't be surprised. But anyway, that's what I heard.
Yeah, well, I mean, these are the kind of things we tend to not find out one way or the other. But that would make sense if they're recording it tomorrow, right? I mean, that would probably be the day they'd be recording it. My thought while watching the show was I wish that Cy Coleman could have lived to see it. Because overall, I think it's a wonderful production, and just to see the audience reacting to it so blissfully. I didn't especially, except for in the overture at one point where the strings are supposed to take over, and it was obvious at that point that there were very few of them. That's the only moment in the show when I really thought to myself, gee, I wish the orchestra could be bigger. I think it's about 13.
13 is what I've heard.
Yeah. So it's not like it's 8 or 9, which the Roundabout tried to foist on us in some of the Sondheim revivals. So that was another bit of relatively good news. Let's see. Oh, in reference to Andy Carl's body, here's an interesting thing, and I hate to harp on this. A friend of mine saw the show during previews and said that Andy was wearing what we would call a tank top, or that horrific term, a wife beater. Mm-hmm. You know, you know what I mean. With a very, very, yes. And he said that he was distracted because my friend was distracted because apparently they had attempted to cover Andy's tattoos and it didn't really work. So it looked like either like he had a rash or a bunch, like a clump of dirt on his arm. And I know that when I saw the show, he was not wearing a tank top. He was wearing a, you know, a short, regular short sleeve shirt. Although, as someone else pointed out, the neckline was very low to show off his pecs. but I wonder if that was the specific reason that that choice was made. And again, regardless, what I would say is to actors: if you're actors, don't get tattoos. That's just my opinion.
I agree,
because they should not have to change that for that reason. Mm-hmm. And you know, anyway, point made. Peter, I was wondering, and whoever else has seen it, what your thoughts were on the rewrite of the song "The Legacy," which is now called "Because of Her." I have very mixed feelings about it because I realize why they rewrote it. I wrote down some of the references in the original song. Oscar is singing about, you know, his legacy and his history in the theater, and he mentions Henry Irving, he mentions Flora Dora, Ellen Terry, even Luchow's. Does anyone even know what Luchow's is anymore?
I ate at Luchow's, yeah. 14th Street, sure.
And isn't Luchow's supposedly the basis for the Harmonia Gardens?
Yep.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you know, we could say, well, you shouldn't have to rewrite everything that just because people don't necessarily understand it now. But I can see why if a song is being performed and you're getting the impression that nobody knows what he's talking about, there would be the temptation to rewrite. I don't know if they had to rewrite so drastically, if Amanda Green had to go in a whole new direction for it. Maybe she could have changed Luchow's to Sardi's. When did Sardi's open?
I don't know, but I will say this. I saw the original Legacy performed 14 times during the original run of On the 20th Century. And our faithful listener, John Moss, disagrees with me on this. We've already talked about this. But I thought it got polite applause each of those 14 times. His memory is that it stopped the show, that people went crazy for the number. And I don't feel that at all. I don't think it's a strong enough number. And as a result, I don't mind that Amanda Green tried to improve it. The idea of Oscar becoming more human and talking about Lily's influence on his life is something else that John and I have disagreed with, because he says, no, come on, that's not this type of show. Well, if it's not this type of show, then why are they singing Our Private World in the middle of the first act, which is a very serious and sincere number? So I don't think it's out of bounds for Oscar to get sentimental about Lily Garland at the end of the show. I think the orchestration hurts it terribly, the new one, and I don't think it works. I think it's a little strangely jaunty for what's being said. So I think they still haven't solved this problem. I don't think they had solved it in 78, and I don't think that it's just not good enough a song. And frankly, I even think in 1978, nobody knew what the hell Flora Dora and Ellen Terry and Henry Irving were. I don't. I mean, really.
Well, you know, so. more people did, but a few
more people did. Yes, but I mean, again, it's Rashomon with me and John, so it's entirely possible that number was the sensation that he thought it was, but it's not my memory of it.
For what it's worth, I also remember it not going over terribly well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you are. So I thought it was a noble attempt to try to improve it. That's the way I look at it, but it enough said. Enough said.
Carrie, what did you think about it?
Well, I had not seen the original production and had never heard the cast recording before, so I came in with a completely blank slate, and I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was exactly what it was trying to be, a screwball comedy, hilarious, great singing. I'd never seen Kristen in a better role. I'd never seen her be that funny before, and it was just a delight to watch her own that entire stage. I thought she sounded fantastic and was just hilarious. And I thought Peter sounded good. I never would have guessed he would have been out as often as he was before I saw him. I don't think his singing was the strongest I've ever heard on Broadway, but I think he played the role very well. And I thought Andy Carl stopped the show with his crazy antics. I especially enjoyed when he was doing bicep curls using Kristen as the weights.
Yeah. Yeah, that was terrific.
I was glad to see him show off how hilarious he can be as well.
Yeah, he really was. If you have not seen it, Carrie, you should catch up with the film 20th Century sometime.
I'll have to add that to my Netflix queue.
It's really interesting, the changes. A lot is exactly the same, and a lot is very different. Like Mrs. Primrose is a guy.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Mildred Plotka thing, the whole way she morphs from Mildred Plotka to Lily Garland is completely different. It's really interesting.
So I saw it on Friday night, and I loved it, and I'm going to be a minority report on on Peter because I don't know if he had an off night or what the thing was, but I felt he was really miscast in it. I don't think he had the vocal ability to do it, and otherwise, I loved the production. And none of you have mentioned the Four Porters.
Yeah, sorry.
And there's a little social media thing going around that people are trying to ask people to consider them for a special Tony, the four of them together. And I don't know about that. I thought that they were really good.
I thought
that they were really good. I don't know if there's a special Tony there.
I agree.
What would the award be?
A special.
Special,
in
special.
No category, you know, and in addition to all our other awards we're giving, I don't see that happening at all. But I will say this again, 14 times seeing those Porters do Life is Like a Train. I never saw a reaction like I saw the other night. I mean, they certainly trumped the aces of the four Porters back in 78. That has to be the most Dadaist number in Broadway history. Life is Like a Train. I mean, it is so bizarre. And I remember my friend Paul Roberts calling me from Boston when the show was trying out there saying, you're not going to believe what they put in the beginning of the second act. Listen to these lyrics, will you? Listen. You know, I wrote them down. You know, so they are bizarre. But anyway, the Porters really were sensational. So I'm glad you brought them up, James.
Although it did occur to me, and I'm sure we're not going to get into a big discussion of this, but in the original production, the four Porters were black or African American, whichever. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if they were specifically African American. This time, I believe only one of them is, and you have to ask yourself, well, did they? I assume they did that specifically because they didn't want them to be stereotypical. And in fact, just recently, I watched a documentary. That was about the black experience, and it mentioned how, I guess, Pullman, right? The Pullman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He hired freed slaves to be the porters, and the documentary made the point that on the one hand, their wages were incredibly low, but on the other hand, they were still being paid as, you know, and had jobs as free men, and it helped many of them to become self-sufficient. But the reason I thought of it was, well, I think we would all agree that the Porters are four of the greatest parts in 20th century. So do you purposely make three of them not African American, in order because of political correctness? But and then do you cast some African Americans in like basically faceless ensemble roles to compensate? That would be a little ironic, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would. I agree with that entirely. However, I have to say that it didn't bother me for a tenth of a second that they weren't black. I agree with you. It would be more historically accurate if they were, but
I'm just approaching it in the terms of the opportunity to be one of those four people, and maybe they said, well, we don't want all of them to be because that's just too politically incorrect. So it's very complex, and I just wanted to mention it because I know I didn't.
So I guess last year or so we had Andy Carl on the broadcast. And we talked specifically about his tattoos and things like that.
Oh, did we?
Yeah. And it was interesting because he's got some tattoos that were modified
for Rocky.
Yeah. And then he got some others after Rocky started and things like that because he really liked what they were doing and things like that. So it's interesting that you brought that up, Michael. And I think that this, this body as a canvas thing is a tough thing for actors because, piercings and tattoos might rule you out of some things.
Did he comment on that at all?
Not really, because we were, I think it was Lindsay Behrens from Maximu who was on and talking with Andy and me at the time, and I think it was Lindsay who had brought it up and asked him about it. Not positive about that, but he said that he had tattoos prior to it that were, then that he spends a lot of time in the makeup chair for Rocky prior to the show to get, because some of the tattoo designs that were in Rocky were not his. They were specifically right. for the show.
Right.
So,
I may wish she had asked him that, but maybe I'll ask him someday.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's move forward to the Heidi Chronicles. Carrie and Michael got a chance to see it. Peter and I are going to see it later on this week and next week. So, Carrie, why don't you start us off with Heidi Chronicles? Tell us a little bit of background about it, and also tell us about your article that you wrote.
Well, it's probably the best known of Wendy's plays, and this is the first major Broadway revival of it. And for the first installment of my new column for Playbill, A Woman's World, I interviewed Pam McKinnon, the director, and we talked quite a bit about the timeliness of the play and if it will still speak to a present-day audience regarding the political, social, economic issues that it introduces to us through Heidi's life. And having interviewed Elizabeth Moss and many other of the cast members as well, I asked them all if they think women can, quote, have it all, which is a phrase that's used very frequently in the play. And I think that the Heidi Chronicles is just as relevant today to an audience in 2015 as it was when it was first done, if not even more so, because of some of the pressures placed on women nowadays. A lot of the cast members and I spoke about how Senator Gillibrand says women don't have it all, they have to do it all. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think that Pam's direction really highlights that in such a beautiful, humane way, because I personally think the best way to introduce people to new issues or concerns is to present them through people and to inspire sympathy and empathy. And Elizabeth's performance as Heidi is so beautifully poignant and real and quiet in a way. Her big speech in the second act when she's addressing her college as a successful alumni just had me on the edge of my seat. And I'd read that speech. I almost knew that speech by heart, but I still couldn't wait to hear what she was going to say next. I think it's just such a great thing to have that play back on Broadway, especially with some of the political and cultural dialogue going on right now. And I can't say enough good things about it.
All right. So, Michael, what did you think about it?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is going to be a different opinion. I had an odd reaction to the play. I completely agree that the play absolutely holds up in terms of its examination of women's issues. I didn't feel it was dated at all, maybe because I lived through all of that, you know, not as a woman, but I could certainly see it happening. So I think some people were concerned that it wouldn't hold up in that respect. I really didn't think there was a moment when I felt it seemed dated in that regard. But boy, I just really was amazed. I saw it originally. I have not seen it since then. Am I correct that there was a TV production?
Yeah.
Yes. Jamie Lee Curtis.
Right. Yeah. I haven't seen that. I literally have only experienced it once before, and that was with the original production with Joan Allen, et cetera. But my reaction to this was that every other line in the play was some kind of glib, snarky pop culture reference joke. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not a lot. If they're not joking about a school that someone went to, they're joking about a neighborhood or a restaurant or a movie or a book. Boston comes up as the butt of a joke just to have a joke about Boston that's not even really funny. I don't think that's considered good playwriting to do it that much. And I was really quite amazed by how much she did it, even though some of them were funny. Quite a few of them were funny. But I don't think that's considered good playwriting. And I'm surprised that it was back then. There are lots of humor based on stereotype, which again, lots of humor is based on stereotype, and that's nothing new. But there was so much of it that the whole thing kind of left a really bad taste in my mouth. And unfortunately, it didn't help that I did not like I really did not like Elizabeth Moss at all, for two reasons. I think that her voice, when she is projecting on stage, acquires a very unpleasant quality to it, a very kind of thin and grating quality, and somewhat nasal too. So I imagine this is not really a problem she has on television. I've only seen a little bit of Mad Men, so I can't really speak to that. And then I also thought she had some really odd choices in her line readings, where to the point of like stressing the wrong word in a sentence. In several sentences, she would say a line and I would say, wait a minute, shouldn't she have stressed that other word? It seemed very odd to me. I thought Tracy Chimo was great. I thought all of the supporting people were wonderful. Bryce Pinkham was fantastic, very different than in in The Gentleman's Guide. And I think Jason Biggs is just about perfect for the part of a really kind of, well, someone else described him as a douchebag. I mean, he's not the most admirable person in the world. Scoop Rosenbaum. Two other things I have to mention. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's my suspension of disbelief. I don't know. There are so many things that just completely take me out of plays and don't seem to bother other people. Are we supposed to think it's realistic that Scoop kisses Heidi at his wedding reception? You know, in a room that anyone could walk into at any moment? Are we also, you know, really supposed to believe that Scoop and Peter would continually cut off Heidi when she's trying to talk during an interview with the three of them after she gets three words out? And are we really supposed to believe that under any circumstances anyone would have a breakdown in the middle of giving a speech to their alumni speech to their high school? And if they did start to lose it, don't we think that they would walk off rather than keep on going? I realize it's heightened reality, but I guess it's just too heightened for me. And all of those things just took me completely out of the play.
Well, I think that Scoop's selfishness is his defining character, and
that's true.
he's a complete narcissist, and if he wanted to kiss someone else, he was going to kiss someone else. When I read the play prior to seeing it, I thought, oh my God, really? But I bought it. I bought Jason's performance as this smug, entitled narcissist.
Well, but what about her accepting it? You know, I mean,
it showed the power that he had over her that she had talked about at the consciousness raising scene, that she knew cerebrally that he wasn't the person for her, but when she was with him, she just lost her control.
Yeah.
And I kind of viewed it as a goodbye kiss as well. But he was the most selfish person, and that was what he wanted to do, so he did it.
Well,
did you guys know that there were some lines restored in this production that weren't in the original?
No.
Pam mentioned that when I interviewed her, and it's in the very last scene when Scoop asks her if her daughter is her solution, and she says, no, Judy is my decision. They learned about that while preparing for this production and decided to bring those lines back into the show, and I thought they were great.
Yeah, well, I think that's very good line to have at that point.
Yeah, I wondered why they had cut them out prior.
Oh. It's I'm so looking forward to seeing it now, because you think you know something, and then I hear two people who I have a tremendous amount of respect for that have two diametrically opposing positions on it. But I'm looking forward to it, and Peter and I are going to see it next week, and we will talk about it again after we see it.
I only read the Times review, so I don't know what the others are like. But the Times was pretty much a rave, with nothing negative said at all, as far as I recall. So whatever that's worth. But just briefly, you guys, the constant jokey pop cultural references didn't bother you?
They didn't bother me. No. I was on the emotional journey. I am incredibly grateful to see this kind of story on Broadway with an actress like Elizabeth playing it. And as a woman in her early 30s, very focused on my own career and very proudly a feminist, I related to it. I was really caught up in Heidi's journey. And when the first act ended and the lights went on for intermission, I turned to my friend and said, "Already? I want more. I want more." Even though I knew that was permission because I'd read the play.
Well, you got a lot more because also I could not believe how long the second act was.
It didn't feel long to me at all. I was completely there with them. I see a lot of plays about a lot of subjects, but this is one that just struck so many chords with me, and I'm so glad that more people are being introduced to it. And it didn't feel long to me at all. There have been 90-minute plays where I think, what am I going to eat for dinner after this? But when this ended, I was like, I want to see it again. I want to come back tomorrow and see it again.
Interesting. Well, people will go and they will see.
Yeah. All right. So let's move forward on to Paint Your Wagon, where Michael and Peter got a chance to see that. So, Peter, why don't you give us a start on Paint Your Wagon?
I thought it was one of the best encores ever. I was amazed at how well it played because I had read the script for a preview article I was doing. And I have rarely seen an instance where a director has trusted the material as much as Mark Bruni did. And my hat is really off to him for not camping it up, even though it takes place in the mining camp, and not doing anything like that whatsoever. He really played it as if it were life and death issues. And not only was Keith Carradine wonderful as Ben Rumson, the man who stakes a claim out during the gold rush out in California and expects he's going to make a fortune, but his daughter Jennifer, played by Alexander Socha, who I had adored last year in Fun Home. I thought she was sensational beyond belief. Here she's completely different, of course, and she rose to this occasion. This is a major, major musical talent, I believe, because she got into this character of this girl who is 16 years old. Suddenly the miners are noticing that she's blossomed, and they lust for her. She doesn't understand what's going on at first. She does fall in love with another man, a Mexican man, and that poses problems of mixed race marriage type thing, whether or not that isn't really stressed as much as you might think, which may be a good thing that it isn't stressed. I mean, we get the point. It doesn't hit us over the head. Mark Rossito did some judicious editing, and I don't remember when I read the script that it was established that when she came back from going east to school that she was 18 years old now. And that's just, I think if Mark Rossito added that line, that's a very good idea, because suddenly she's of age to start cavorting with Julio. Everybody was wonderful. The choreography was sensational. Having all those robust masculine voices singing out one of the great opening numbers, I Am On My Way, a terrific song. Yeah, my girlfriend, by the way, was going to go with me. And this week, Paint Your Wagon, the movie was on. And she said, I watched a half hour. I am not going. I said, Linda, it's very different. Yeah, I'm telling you, I am not going. Forget it. You know, I mean, it's just not happening. And so I invited my wonderful friend Karen Plesher, who had a terrific – it wasn't just, you know, intermission saying, yeah, this is good. It was, I love it. I love it. And that's what it was worth doing. It was worth loving. So it's a tremendously successful production. And, you know, it just shows what encores you never know. I mean, Paint Your Wagon ran about half as long as Irma La Douce when it was on Broadway. Those shows were on Broadway. So, you know, and there was Irma La Douce, nobody liked at all. And everybody had higher hopes for it, perhaps, because it was a hit in its day. You know, it yielded a far more successful movie, even though they didn't use the score. Paint Your Wagon completely reinvented itself. And, you know, it's so funny, too, when you think of it. Paint Your Wagon was one of those movies in the 60s that killed the movie musical because it did no business. I mean, it was one of the great disasters of all time. And the irony is that when you think about it, it really was pretty saucy. I mean, if people would have given it a chance, The Simpsons didn't, by the way, on one episode. If people had given it a chance, they would the kids in those days who were experimenting with sex would be very interested in the story about this woman who is being shared by two minors, Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood, both sleeping with Gene Seberg in the movie. None of that happens in this version, and we have to blame Alan J. Lerner for the movie, because he and Patty Chayefsky were right there and doing the rewrite. But I'm getting off the track. What I have to reiterate is this is a terrific production, and it really is a production. Because, you know, remember the days when everybody carried a book at Encores? This may be the first one where nobody carried a book in any way, shape, or form. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, there are no books to be seen, you know, except the
solid book. You must have changed the equity contract then.
I guess so. I agree with that. Or maybe equity said, all right, look, you know, the hell with it. I mean, you know, we see you've been using fewer and fewer books, and, you know, good luck to you. I don't know. But I'm telling you, try to find a book on that stage, aside from Alan J. Lerner's excellent book for this. It really works tremendously well, and I was so pleasantly surprised.
Michael, what did you think?
Well, first of all, yeah, to that first point, we've discussed it before. I think I'm not sure if Equity. I had heard that Equity had revisited it, but yep. I'm not sure exactly what they decided. I don't know if it depends on exactly how much rehearsal they have for each show. Like, maybe 2 days more might make a difference in terms of whether or not they're required to carry the scripts or not. As we remember, Lady Be Good, those people had some scripts, mm-hmm. But I think Little Me, if I recall, the only person I recall having a script in Little Me was Judy Kaye, but maybe I'm not remembering that correctly.
I remember that. She was the only one who had a book.
You do remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, or at any rate, she was the only one who referred to it. Maybe that's why I remember it. So I completely have no idea. and we should ask that, because it's an interesting question.
It is.
Also, Peter, not to correct you, but because someone just told me yesterday, actually a mutual friend of ours, financially, the film of Paint Your Wagon was not a disaster, although most people seem to think, agree that it's artistically a disaster.
Did it make money?
I didn't actually look it up, but I don't think – I think it like was one of those kind of break-even things,
yeah,
or a little more than that. It was – I think they said the 12th highest grossing film of the year, which is not – which is really not that bad. Mm. Likewise, Camelot, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Camelot was a hit, even though we may think, oh,
yeah,
Jesus.
Yeah. Sure.
Anyway, I completely agree with Peter that is one of the very best encores ever. And for the reasons that he said, in addition to the cast members that Peter mentioned, we have to mention this Nathaniel Hackman guy, mm-hmm. Who I guess is in Les Mis. I'm not sure if he's the cover for Valjean or if he's an understudy, but God almighty, when he came down and sang down center stage, you know, center front, and sang They Call the Wind Mariah. I thought this, you know, this is like musical theater heaven. His voice is unbelievably beautiful and powerful and just the right type. And I think he's going to, you know, they don't write a lot of shows like that anymore, but they still do write some, like, for example, Dr. Zhivago. So I hope he has a brilliant career because he deserves to. What else did I want to say? Oh, I have access to the original script of Paint Your Wagon, so I was able to check some things. But I know that there were some previous rewrites for a tour. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that script is in Theater Arts magazine. The one they remember Theater Arts, which used to put a play in the center of the issue every month, and occasionally a musical, Once Upon a Mattress, Little Mary Sunshine, Most Happy Fellow. They all made Theater Arts magazine.
Well, I haven't looked at that one, but it would be interesting to compare that, because I'm not 100% as to which changes were made for this production.
Yeah, I agree. I don't need
by Mark Esceto, and which were from the tour. But I will say this, in the original, for example, in the beginning, during the I'm on my way number, mm-hmm. they don't have that. The original doesn't have that exaggeration running joke where, oh, somebody found a gold line and it's 100 miles long and 10 miles wide. And then the next person says it's 200 miles long and 3000 miles, yeah. You know, so that's not in there. I believe that I was told that Ben's Tall Tales aren't in there. And also, the very ending of this production, which was incredibly reminiscent to me of Finian's Rainbow, the girl is standing there with her new lover, and her father decides he's going to go, and she's like, "Where are you going?" And he basically says, "Oh, I'm going off to find my, you know, my bliss or whatever." Right. That's not in it either. I mean, the dialogue isn't there. Ben does leave at the end, but that exchange between him and Jennifer and Julio is not there at the end. So it's interesting how it's changed over the years. I would love to hear. Carrie, did you see it?
No, I didn't get to.
Well, you know, I would be curious to hear your opinion on the women's issues, because I've been saying to everybody, I think Alan J. Lerner just had a tremendous, tremendous problem with women. To me, the Mormon situation in this show is incredibly distasteful. I went to see it with Stephen Dolganoff, the musical theater writer, and he said, I think at intermission, he said, I was trying to think in my mind how that could be rewritten. Could they have made it that maybe one of the women was his sister, his maiden sister, who he was trying to, who he was trying to kind of marry off? And I said, yeah, you know, that is an excellent idea. But then just when we were decided that that's how you rewrite it, then in Act 2, there's the whole auctioning off one of the women.
Wait,
which,
what?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. You heard him right.
Yeah, yeah. It's incredibly dicey. And of course, it's all treated for comedy, which only makes it worse in a way. And she's supposed to be the woman who's being the wife who's being auctioned off is supposed to be very willing because she doesn't like the arrangement with the other wife and the husband. But still, it just my skin was crawling. And does everyone know that John Marin's is writing another new book for an upcoming production in Seattle. So it will be really interesting to see what he does.
By the way, in terms of Lerner, isn't it interesting that the man who wrote How to Handle a Woman was married 8 times? I mean, you know, I don't think he knew.
This is what I mean.
At which marriage was he in when he wrote that song?
I guess about 4. That would be my guess. Certainly no fewer than 3, I would think.
Well, you know, it's really fat. Somebody must have done a paper on this already or a thesis. His of course, most successful piece is My Fair Lady, which is about a guy who's basically a misogynist aside from everything else. And so many of his shows have all these issues with women. I mean, Gigi, I think, is different because of the source material and the milieu. He seemed to have a lot of unresolved issues.
Well, I think it's really important to, you know, as a cultural feminist, for me to consider the decade, the social, the political context when watching everything. But I will say I'm very curious to see what changes were made to Gigi, how the book was rewritten. I'm very, very curious to see that production and to learn more about it. I know that a lot of changes have been made, and I have read the novella and seen the movie.
Well, I always thought the wonderful thing about Gigi, just briefly from the movie, is that the reason it's all so palatable to me is that Gigi rejects, you know, she does everything possible to avoid that situation where she's going to be a kept woman, Gaston's kept woman. She tries to avoid it through the whole thing. Finally, she gives in at the end only because she says something like, if that's the only way I love you, and if that's the only way I can be with you, I'll do that.
She'd rather be miserable with him than without him.
Well,
that's actually
what
she says.
Right. Yeah, is that the line? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lyric. It really is. It's in her final song. Yeah.
But then, in the new version.
In the 73 version.
Oh, okay. I don't know that version.
She says it as dialogue in the movie.
But in the film, then as soon as she makes that decision, then Gaston realizes that she was right all along. He realizes how this feels so wrong to him when he takes her out on the town, and then he brings her home, and then he goes out and has a little epiphany and comes back and asks to marry her. So I always thought that that's why whatever is questionable in Gigi is very, very acceptable, because she is the the power of the story, and she's the one who is smart enough and sensitive enough and intelligent enough to really resist doing that through the whole thing until she gives in, and then she regrets it.
By the way, my last statement for the day, because I have to run, is that Alan J. Lerner was on Wife Number 4 when he was writing Camelot. So yes, How to Handle a Woman. Okay, please forgive. I got to run. I have to get to New Jersey early, but we'll talk again soon.
All right. So why don't we move forward here, and we'll talk a little bit about The Hunchback of Notre Dame, where Michael and Carrie both got a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Yes, I guess I would say, how can I put this? I don't know if there is some way that there is some power at Disney Theatricals that supersedes the director. Because, for example, Casey Nicholaw has directed some of the best musicals I've seen in the past several years. And then I went into Aladdin and just found it aggressively charmless, way too loud, dumbed down, and overlong. And I, to the point where I almost couldn't believe it was the same person who directed the Book of Mormon and several other really great things, some great encore shows. But then it occurred to me that several other Disney shows, including Hunchback, are like that. Now, Hunchback is directed by Scott Schwartz, but I don't know if they have people who come in and say, oh, make it bigger, make it louder, make it more melodramatic. 'Cause I really did not like it at all. I just didn't like the whole presentation of it. It was just so overbearing and it was very heavy, which is not in itself a problem, but I'm not sure what they think the audience is for something like this, because it's so much darker, as I was told beforehand, even than the film version, the animated film version, which in itself is so much darker than the other Disney animated films, and way, way, way darker than Aladdin, certainly, and even darker than Beauty and the Beast and the other ones. So I'm not sure, because it does have a there's a lot of narration in the show by the members of the ensemble and some of the leads as well. So it has a sort of a story theater or a Pippin kind of tone to it, but also almost as if they were telling a story to younger children. So I'm not sure if it's intended for, I guess it's intended for adults, but it also has other aspects of it that seem very kind of childlike and obvious and overdone. I just really did not like it at all. I like a lot of the music. I think it's beautiful. The key song, I think, from that is carried over from the film is Out There, which Michael Arden does an amazing job of singing. And all of the cast, I thought the cast was great, but I just got this impression that everyone was being made to perform in a way that was just so over the top and so storybookish and exaggerated. So I don't know if this is going to go anywhere else. I will be curious to see. And also, I guess maybe one could do the research and find some kind of unofficial recording somewhere, but it'd be interesting to compare it to the previous version that James Lapine did. Which was he did the one that was in Germany. Is that right?
And then, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks. I'm glad somebody here knows what's going on. I imagine that's very, very different. And I think that one was supposed to be much smaller and more intimate. One other thing that hurt, Hunchback at Paper Mill tremendously. I think it, Peter agreed with me. In fact, he said it before I did, was the unit set. It's sort of like a basic wooden unit set. It may be supposed to represent the bell ringing area in Notre Dame, although it's wooden, it's not stone, so I'm not sure what that's supposed to be. But anyway, the outer structure remains through the entire show. So when you have the moment, for example, when Quasimodo finally leaves Notre Dame and he's supposed to be out in the square and he's finally free, you don't really get any sense of that. And then when he keeps, you know, people keep singing about Sanctuary, you don't really get any sense that of any change because he's always in that space. So I think that they would have done better if they had a less massive unit set and been able to fly things in and out in order to represent what's inside and what's outside, because I think the story is largely about that.
All right, Carrie, what did you think about it?
I enjoyed it. I knew that they were trying to target a different audience, that it wasn't the same adaptation that had been made into the Disney film. They had specifically been saying that no children under the age of 12 should probably see it. I did see a few children under the age of 12 when I went to see it and wondered about the conversations in the drive home that night. I think that what really stood out to me were the performances. I thought that Michael Arden was fantastic as Quasimodo. I was so moved by him. His voice was just gorgeous, and he really captured the innocence of that character, the innocence of someone who had been locked up his whole life and who only knew one kind of love. And Patrick Page, who always dazzles me with his performances, just took it to a new level as Frollo. I couldn't take my eyes off him when he was on stage, and I thought that his performance of Hellfire was the best song in the show for me. It's kind of a dark thing to say, but I was so moved by how he depicted these conflicting desires of wanting to be a religious, a pure, a good man, but someone who is experiencing lust and conflict and obsession to a level where he would go burn down buildings and capture people all just for the sake of quenching this desire. Mm. And I had interviewed him before I saw the show, and he had spoken about how the constraints of very intense religion do affect people like that. And I thought he really honored that beautifully in his performance. And Sierra Renee playing Esmeralda, I thought she was fantastic. She really showed a very spirited, driven, brave woman. She was a lot more than simply a beautiful heroine. And I really appreciated that. It was a very dark show. It affected me very deeply at the end. I had not read the book, so I actually didn't know how everyone's story would end up. But I enjoyed it. I was glad to see it.
I liked Sierra Renee a lot too. I thought she did seem very modern, very contemporary, but I don't know if that's inappropriate for, you know, the type of show that they're doing anyway. I mean, it's not exactly attempting to sound like like it's what year is it supposed to be? the late, it's supposed to be like the when is the,
I think it's the 15th century or
16th century. I was going to say that. I was like, it couldn't be that old, could it? But I think it is. Andrew Szymanski also, he plays Phoebus. There's a lot more music we should mention if we a lot more music, yeah. Some music and lyrics in the show than are in the film, and he and Ciara benefited from that, a lot of more material for them, but really for everybody. And they also, Paper Mill has brought in a chorus, a separate chorus just to sing these, mostly these Latin choral hymns that are really quite majestic, and they have a huge orchestra as always. So, I mean, I thought the show was too loud, but I guess that goes without saying that I think every show is too loud. but the actual sound that they were making was quite something. Some of it sounded like Carmina Burana. Some of it sounded like The Exorcist. If you like that kind of big, huge choral sound, you're going to probably really enjoy those parts of this show.
So I did a little research here. it ran in Berlin for 3 years, from 1999 to 2003, with the music by Alan Menken, lyrics by Stephen Schwartz, and book and direction by James LaPine.
Yep. Yep.
And seemingly replaced for this production, assuming it's the same music and lyrics. So it's interesting. And Wikipedia has it listed as a Broadway destination in 2015-16. So interesting.
This production? Yeah. Oh, wow. All right, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Well, then I don't know. I don't even remember if did they do it in English in Germany or did
no?
They
it was in German.
So they wrote it in English and then translated it. Somebody translated it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Der Glockner von Notre Dame.
Oh yes. Thank you, James.
I've sure I gotten all of those words wrong. All right. So actually, we ran a lot longer than I thought. So why don't we wrap it up for today? I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that we each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many different ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for me, and for Carrie can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Peter Felicio, Michael Portantier, and Carrie Purcell, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Max, I really, really love this place.